the people raised the same cries, calling on God to provide for their safety and to deliver the Israelites in every land from the calamity about to fall on them, for they already saw it before their eyes and were expecting it. Esther too entreated God according to the custom of her people, throwing herself to the ground, putting on mourning garments, and for 3 days abstaining from food, drink, and every pleasure, asking God to have mercy on her and to grant that when she was seen by the king she might, by both means at once, be persuasive in her words and lovelier in appearance than she had ever been, so that she might use both her plea to turn aside his anger, should the king be provoked against her. And her advocacy on behalf of her countrymen now tossed on the very edge of ruin, and so that hatred might arise in the king against the enemies of the Jews, who were contriving destruction for them, should they be neglected by him. Having entreated God in this way for 3 days, she then took off that mourning garment and changed her appearance, and adorned as a queen ought to be, with 2 handmaids, one of whom bore her up lightly as she leaned on her, while the other followed, holding up with the tips of her fingers the deep, trailing hem of her gown that spread to the ground. She came before the king, her face full of a blush, but wearing an expression at once gentle and dignified beneath her beauty. She entered his presence in fear. But when she came opposite him as he sat on the throne, arrayed in his royal ornament, this consisted of richly worked robes, gold, and precious stone, he seemed more terrible, and all the more so for these very things when she looked at him. And as he too glanced at her rather harshly, his face still inflamed with anger. A faintness at once overcame her, and she collapsed, senseless, into the arms of those standing beside her. But the king, by the will of God, I think, changed his mind, and fearing for the woman lest she suffer some harm from her fright, leapt up from his throne, and, catching her in his arms, revived her, embracing her and speaking to her gently, urging her to take heart and to suspect nothing grim in the fact that she had come to him uncalled. For that law, he said, was laid down for his subjects, while she, who reigned equally with him, enjoyed complete freedom from it. As he said this, he placed her scepter in her hand and extended his rod toward her neck, releasing her from the fear the law required. Reviving at this, she said, "My lord, I cannot easily tell you what suddenly came over me, for when I saw you, so great, so handsome, and so terrible, my breath at once failed me, and I was abandoned by my own spirit." As she said even this with difficulty, and in a faint voice, anguish and agitation seized him too, and he encouraged Esther to take heart and to expect better things, promising that he would grant her even half his kingdom, should she need it. But Esther asked that he come to a banquet with his friend Haman, saying that she had prepared a dinner for him. When he assented and they were present, in the midst of the drinking he told Esther to make known to him what she wanted, for she would fail in nothing, even if she wished to take half the kingdom. But she put off telling him her wish until the next day, if he would come to her again for a banquet, together with Haman. When the king had agreed, Haman went out overjoyed that he alone had been thought worthy to dine with the king at Esther's table, and because no one else received such honor from the kings. But seeing Mordecai in the courtyard he grew furious, since Mordecai showed him no mark of honor even on catching sight of him. Going into his own house, he called for his wife Zeresh and his friends, and in their presence recounted the honor he enjoyed not only from the king but from the queen as well. For that very day when he had dined with her alone, together with the king, he would be invited back again the next day. He said, too, that he took no pleasure in seeing the Jew Mordecai in the courtyard. His wife Sisara told him to order a beam cut, 60 cubits long, and in the morning to ask the king for leave to impale Mordecai on it. Pleased with the plan, he ordered his servants to prepare the beam and set it up in the courtyard, ready for Mordecai's punishment. This was all made ready, but God laughed at Haman's wicked hope, and knowing what was to happen, took pleasure in what was coming. For that very night he took sleep away from the king. Unwilling to let his wakefulness pass idly, but wanting to spend it on some matter of use to the kingdom, the king had his secretary bring the records of the kings before him and of his own deeds, and ordered him to read them aloud. As the secretary brought them and read, it was found that a certain man had received an estate as a reward for valor, his name being recorded there. He also mentioned another who had been granted a gift for loyalty, and came to the case of Gabathas and Theodestes, the eunuchs who had plotted against the king, whose informer had been Mordecai. When the secretary had said only this and was moving on to another matter, the king stopped him, asking whether the man had not been given some reward recorded for this. The secretary said there was none. The king ordered him to be silent and asked those appointed for the purpose what hour of the night it was. Learning that it was already dawn, he ordered that whichever of his friends they should find already present before the courtyard should be brought in to him. It happened that Haman was the one found there, for he had come earlier than his usual hour to ask the king for Mordecai's death. When the attendant said that Haman was before the courtyard, the king ordered him called in. When he had entered, the king said, "Since I know that you alone are well disposed toward me, I ask your advice. How might I honor someone whom I love greatly, in a manner worthy of my own greatness of spirit?" Haman, reasoning that whatever counsel he gave would be given on his own behalf, for he supposed himself alone to be loved by the king, made known what he thought was the best plan. He said, "If you wish to surround with glory the man you say you love, have him ride on horseback wearing your own robe and a golden collar, and have one of your closest friends go before him proclaiming through the whole city that this is the honor bestowed on the man whom the king delights to honor." So Haman gave this counsel, thinking that this reward would fall to himself. The king, pleased with the advice, came forward and said, "You have the horse, the robe, and the collar. Go seek out Mordecai the Jew and give these things to him, leading his horse yourself. For you," he said, "are my dear friend, be his attendant, since you have proven a good counselor. This shall be his reward from us for saving my life." Hearing this against all expectation, Haman's mind was thrown into confusion, and struck with helplessness, he went out leading the horse, the purple robe, and the golden collar, and finding Mordecai before the courtyard dressed in sackcloth, he ordered him to put it off and put on the purple robe. Mordecai, not knowing the truth but thinking he was being mocked, said, "Worst of men, do you mock our misfortunes like this?" But when he was persuaded that the king had truly given him this honor, in return for the safety he had provided, by exposing the eunuchs who had plotted against him, he put on the purple robe which the king himself always wore, and put on the collar, and mounting the horse rode around the city with Haman going before him, and proclaiming that this would be done by the king's order for whomever he loved and judged worthy of honor. When they had gone all around the city, Mordecai went in to the king, while Haman, from shame, went home, and with tears told his wife and friends what had happened. They said he could no longer defend himself against Mordecai, for God was with him. While they were still talking with one another about this, the eunuchs of Esther arrived, hurrying Haman to the banquet. Sabachadas, one of the eunuchs, having seen the steak set up in Haman's house, which they had prepared for Mordecai, and having learned from one of the servants for whom it had been prepared, realized it was meant for the queen's uncle, for Haman was intending to ask the king for it, for his punishment, but for the time being he kept quiet. When the king, feasting with Haman, asked the queen to tell him what gift she wished to receive, assuring her she would obtain whatever she desired, she lamented the danger to her people, and said she had been handed over to destruction along with her nation, and that this was why she was speaking of the matter, for she would not have troubled him if they had merely been ordered sold into bitter slavery. That would have been a moderate evil, but she begged to be delivered from this. When the king asked by whom this had been done, she now openly accused Haman, charging that he, being wicked, had contrived this plot against them. The king, disturbed at this, sprang up from the banquet and went out into the gardens, while Haman began to beg Esther and implore her to forgive his wrongdoing, for he now understood that he was in trouble. He fell upon her couch and was pleading with the queen when the king came back in, and, all the more provoked at the sight, said, "Worst of all men, do you even try to force my wife?" At this, Haman was struck with terror and could no longer say a word. Then Sabuzanes the eunuch came forward and accused Haman, saying he had found a stake set up at Haman's house, prepared for Mordecai, for the servant, when asked, had told him this, when he had come to summon him to the banquet, and he said the stake was 60 cubits high. When the king heard this, he decided on no other punishment for Haman than the one devised for Mordecai, and ordered that he be hanged from that very stake and put to death at once. Hence I am led to marvel at the divine and to observe its wisdom and justice, in that it not only punished Haman's wickedness, but made the very punishment he had contrived against another fall upon himself, teaching everyone else to understand that whatever a man prepares against another, he unknowingly prepares first against himself. Thus Haman, through the immoderate use of the honor the king gave him, was destroyed in this manner, and the king gave his estate to the queen. He then summoned Mordecai, for Esther had revealed to him her kinship with him, and gave him the ring he had given to Haman. The queen also gave Mordecai Haman's property, and begged the king to free the Jewish nation from the fear for their lives, disclosing what had been written throughout the country by Haman son of Hammedatha. For since her homeland had been destroyed and her kinsmen were perishing, she said she could not bear to go on living. The king promised that nothing unpleasant would happen to her, nor anything contrary to what she was eager for, and ordered her to write whatever she wished concerning the Jews in the king's name, and having sealed it with his ring, to send it throughout the kingdom. For those who read letters secured with the royal seal would not oppose anything written in them. So he summoned the royal scribes and ordered them to write to the nations concerning the Jews, and to the stewards and governors of the 127 satrapies from India to Ethiopia. What was written ran in this manner: The great King Artaxerxes, to the governors and those loyal to us, greetings. Many men, because of the greatness of the benefits and honor which they enjoyed through the excessive kindness of their benefactors, not only grow insolent toward their inferiors, but do not hesitate to wrong even those who benefited them, stripping gratitude from among men and through tastelessness, thinking that the surfeit of goods they did not expect will let them escape the notice of the divine in these matters and escape justice from it. And some of these, entrusted by their friends with the management of affairs, and holding private hatred toward certain persons, have deceived those in power with false charges and slanders, and persuaded them to take up anger against people who had done no wrong, by which they were brought into danger of destruction. This is a thing to be seen not from more ancient times nor known to us only by hearsay, but from what has been dared before our own eyes, so that from now on we should pay no heed to slanders and accusations, nor to what others attempt to persuade us of, but should judge according to what each man himself knows to have been done, punishing where such things are so, but showing favor where matters stand otherwise, holding to the deeds themselves, and not to those who speak of them. As for Haman, son of Hammedatha, an Amalekite by race, a stranger to Persian blood, who, received among us as a guest, enjoyed our kindness toward all so greatly that he came to be called my father and continued to be bowed down to, and to receive after us the second place of royal honor from everyone. He did not bear his good fortune, nor did he manage the greatness of his blessings with sound judgment, but plotted against my kingdom and my life, seeking to remove from me the man responsible for my authority, and by wicked and deceitful means sought the destruction of my benefactor and savior Mordecai and of Esther, the partner of my life and my rule. For by this means, having stripped me of those loyal to me, he intended to turn the kingdom over to others. But I, having recognized that the Jews handed over to destruction by that accursed man are not wicked, but conduct themselves in the best manner as citizens and hold fast to God, who has preserved the kingdom for me and for our ancestors, not only release them from the punishment contained in the earlier letters, which you will do well to disregard, but also wish them to receive every honor. And the man who contrived these things against them, I have impaled before the gates of Susa, together with his family, God who watches over all things having brought this judgment upon him. I command you, having set up a copy of this letter throughout the whole kingdom, to allow the Jews to live by their own laws in peace, and to help them so that they may take vengeance on those who wronged them in their time of misfortune, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is Adar, on that same day. For God has made this day one of salvation instead of destruction for them. It is a good reminder for those loyal to us, and a memorial of the punishment of those who plotted against them. I wish every city and every nation to know that if anyone disregards what has been written, he will be consumed by fire and sword. Let what has been written be posted throughout the whole country subject to us, and let all make ready for the appointed day, so that they may take vengeance on their enemies. The horsemen carrying the letters set out at once and hastened along the road before them. Mordecai, having put on the royal robe and set the golden crown upon his head and the collar around his neck, went forth. And the Jews in Susa, seeing him so honored by the king, took his good fortune as shared by all. Joy and a light of salvation attended both the Jews in the city and those throughout the country as the king's letters were published, so much so that many of the other nations, out of fear of the Jews, had themselves circumcised and thereby secured their own safety. For on the 13th of the 12th month, which among the Hebrews is called Adar, and among the Macedonians Distros, those who carried the king's letters made known that on the very day they themselves had expected to be in danger, they should instead destroy their enemies. The rulers of the satrapies, the governors, the kings, and the scribes held the Jews in honor, for the fear that came from Mordecai compelled them to act prudently. When the royal letter had gone throughout the whole country subject to him, it happened that the Jews in Susa killed about 500 of their enemies. When the king told Esther the number of those who had perished, and asked, being uncertain what had happened in the country and what she wished to be done further, for it would be carried out, she asked that the Jews be permitted to deal in the same way with the enemies still remaining on the following day as well, and that the 10 sons of Haman be impaled. The king granted this to the Jews, being unable to refuse Esther anything, and they, gathering again on the 14th of the month of Distros, killed about 300 of their opponents and touched none of the property belonging to them. There also died at the hands of the Jews in the country and in the other cities 75,000 of their enemies. These they killed on the 13th of the month and made the following day a festival. Likewise, the Jews in Susa, gathering on the 14th and the day following in the same month, feasted together. For this reason, the Jews throughout the whole world still celebrate these days, sending portions of food to one another. Mordecai wrote to the Jews living in the kingdom of Artaxerxes to observe these days and keep them as a festival, and to hand them down to their descendants, so that the festival should last for all time and not be lost through forgetfulness. For it was right, since they had been intended to perish on these very days at Haman's hands, that having escaped the danger in them and having taken vengeance on their enemies, they should observe them, giving thanks to God. For this reason, the Jews celebrate the aforesaid days, calling them Purim. Mordecai was great and illustrious at the king's court, and shared with him the administration of the kingdom, enjoying at the same time for the Jews, too, things turned out through them far better than anyone had hoped. Such, then, was the outcome of these affairs under the reign of Artaxerxes. When the high priest Eliashib died, his son Jotham succeeded to the high priesthood. And when he too died, his son John received the office. The same John on whose account Bagoses, the general of the other Artaxerxes, defiled the temple and imposed tribute on the Jews, requiring them, before offering the daily sacrifices, to pay 50 drachmas from the public funds for every lamb. The cause of this came about as follows. John had a brother named Jesus. Bagoses, being on friendly terms with him, promised to secure the high priesthood for him. Relying on this assurance, Jesus quarreled with John in the temple and provoked his brother to such a pitch that John killed him. It was a terrible thing that a man should commit so monstrous an impiety against his own brother in the sanctuary itself, worse than anything done before it, so much so that neither among the Greeks nor among barbarians had so savage and impious a deed ever occurred. But the divine did not overlook it. The people were enslaved on this very account, and the temple was defiled by the Persians. Bagoses, the general of Artaxerxes, learning that John, the high priest of the Jews, had murdered his own brother Jesus in the temple, at once came upon the Jews in a rage and began to say, "You have dared to commit murder in your own temple." And when he tried to enter the sanctuary, they tried to stop him. But he said to them, "Am I not purer than the man who was killed in the temple?" And having said this, he went into the sanctuary. Using this pretext, Bagoses harassed the Jews for 7 years over the death of Jesus. When John's life came to its end, his son Jadus succeeded to the high priesthood. He too had a brother, named Manasses. To this man Sanballat, a Cuthean by birth, from whom the Samaritans are descended, who had been sent to Samaria as satrap by Darius, the last king, gladly gave in marriage his own daughter, called Nicaso, thinking that this match would serve as a pledge to secure for himself the goodwill of the whole Jewish nation. At this same time, Philip, king of the Macedonians, was treacherously murdered at Ege by Pausanias, of the family of the Orsti. His son Alexander received the kingdom, and crossing the Hellespont, defeated Darius's generals in battle at the Granicus. Then, advancing through Lydia, enslaving Ionia and overrunning Caria, he pressed on into the regions of Pamphylia, as has been shown elsewhere. Now the elders of Jerusalem, deeply offended that the brother of the high priest Jadis was married to a foreign woman and yet shared in the high priesthood, rose up in opposition to him. For they considered his marriage a stepping stone for those who might wish to transgress the laws concerning marriage to foreign women, and that it would be the beginning of fellowship with foreigners for the whole people. They held, moreover, that their earlier captivity and their misfortunes had been caused precisely by certain men's offenses in the matter of marriages, and by their taking wives who were not of their own people. They therefore demanded that Manasses either divorce his wife or else not approach the altar. When the high priest, sharing the people's indignation, barred his brother from the altar, Manasses went to his father-in-law Sanibalitz and told him that, though he loved his wife Nicaso, he was unwilling to be deprived, on her account, of the priestly honor, which was the greatest dignity in the nation and remained fixed within his family line. Sanibalitz promised not only to preserve the priesthood for him, but also to secure for him the power and honor of a high priest, and to appoint him governor of all the territory he himself ruled, provided he consent to marry his daughter. And he said he would build a temple like the one at Jerusalem on Mount Gerizim, the highest of the mountains of Samaria, and that he would do this with the approval of King Darius. Elated by these promises, Manasses stayed on with Sanibalitz, believing he would obtain the high priesthood as a gift from Darius. For it happened that Sanibalitz was already an old man. But since many priests and Israelites had become entangled in such marriages, no small disturbance gripped the people of Jerusalem, for all of them began to go over to Manasses, Sanibalitz supplying them with money, allotting them land for farming and settlement, and in every way courting favor with his son-in-law. At this same time Darius, hearing that Alexander had crossed the Hellespont, defeated his satraps in the battle at the Granicus, and was advancing farther, gathered together an army of cavalry and infantry, resolved to meet the Macedonians before they could overrun the whole of Asia. So he crossed the river Euphrates, passed over the Taurus range in Cilicia, and waited at Issus in Cilicia to meet the enemy there in battle. Sanibalitz, delighted at Darius's advance, at once told Manasses that he would fulfill his promises as soon as Darius, having defeated the enemy, returned, for he was convinced, as were all the people of Asia, that the Macedonians, given the size of the Persian forces, would not even come to close quarters with the Persians. But it turned out otherwise than they expected. The king engaged the Macedonians and was defeated, losing much of his army. His mother, his wife, and his children were taken captive, and he himself fled into Persia. Alexander, having come into Syria, took Damascus, and after mastering Sidon laid siege to Tyre. He also sent letters demanding that the high priest of the Jews send him aid, supply provisions for his army, and give to him whatever gifts they had previously paid to Darius, choosing the friendship of the Macedonians instead. For otherwise, he said, they would come to regret it. But the high priest answered the letter bearers that he had given oaths to Darius not to bear arms against him, and that he would not break these oaths so long as Darius remained alive. Hearing this, Alexander was enraged, yet he decided not to abandon Tyre, which was on the point of being taken, but resolved that once he had reduced it, he would march against the high priest of the Jews and teach everyone whose oaths they ought to keep. Accordingly, prosecuting the siege with still greater vigor, he took Tyre. Having settled affairs there, he advanced against the city of the people of Gaza and laid siege to Gaza and to its garrison commander, named Babemesis. Sanibalitz, judging the moment favorable for his design, now openly renounced Darius. Taking 8,000 of his subjects, he went over to Alexander, and, finding him just beginning the siege of Tyre, told him that he was handing over to him the territories under his own command, and that he would gladly accept him as master in place of King Darius. Alexander received him gladly, and Sanibalitz, now emboldened concerning the matter he had in view, brought the subject to him, explaining that he had as a son-in-law Manasses, brother of Jadis, the high priest of the Jews, and that many others of his countrymen with him wished now to build a temple in the territory under his rule. This, he said, would also be advantageous to the king, since it would divide the strength of the Jews in two, so that the nation, being neither of one mind nor united, would not prove troublesome to kings should it ever attempt revolt, just as had happened before to the rulers of the Assyrians. Alexander consented, and Sanballats, applying all his energy to the task, built the temple and installed Manasses as its priest, considering this the greatest privilege he could confer on his future grandchildren through his daughter. But when 7 months had passed in the siege of Tyre, and 2 in that of Gaza, Sanballats died. Alexander, having taken Gaza, was eager to go up against the city of Jerusalem. When the high priest Jaddus heard this, he was in anguish and fear, at a loss how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was angered at his earlier refusal to obey. He therefore ordered the people to offer supplication, and together with them offered sacrifice to God, begging him to shield the nation and deliver it from the dangers now approaching. When he had gone to sleep after the sacrifice, God spoke to him in a dream, telling him to take courage, to crown the city with garlands and open its gates, and that the people should go out to meet Alexander dressed in white, while he himself, together with the priests, should go out in their prescribed vestments, expecting to suffer nothing terrible, since God himself was watching over them. Rising from sleep, he rejoiced greatly, made known to everyone the message he had received, did all that had been commanded him in the dream, and awaited the king's arrival. Learning that Alexander was not far from the city, he went out with the priests and the body of the citizens to meet him with a reception fitting the sanctuary, and unlike that of any other nation, at a place called Sapha. This name, translated into Greek, means lookout, for from there one could see both Jerusalem and the temple. Now the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans who accompanied the army, expecting the king's anger to give them license to plunder the city and put the high priest to a shameful death, found the very opposite happen. For Alexander, while still some way off, seeing the multitude clothed in white, the priests standing in front of them in their linen robes, and the high priest himself in his robe of blue and gold, wearing on his head the mitre with the golden plate on which the name of God was inscribed, came forward alone, bowed down before the name, and greeted the high priest first. The Jews with one voice, all together, greeted Alexander and surrounded him. The kings of Syria and the rest, seeing him do this, were astonished and supposed the king's mind had been unhinged. Only Parmenio approached him and asked why, when all men bowed down to him, he himself had bowed down to the high priest of the Jews. "It was not him I bowed to," he said, "but the God whose high priesthood he holds. For it was this very man, in this very dress, whom I saw in a dream when I was at Diem in Macedonia. And as I was turning over in my mind how I might master Asia, he urged me not to delay but to cross over boldly, for he himself would lead my army and hand over to me the empire of the Persians. Since then I have seen no one else clothed in such a manner, but now behold this man, and remember the vision and the exhortation I received in my sleep. I believe that it is under divine guidance that I have made this expedition, and that I shall defeat Darius, overthrow the power of the Persians, and that everything I intend will succeed as I wish." Having said this to Parmenio, he clasped the high priest's hand, and with the Jews running alongside, entered the city. Going up to the temple, he offered sacrifice to God under the high priest's direction, and paid fitting honor to the high priest himself and to the priests. When the book of Daniel was shown to him, in which it was declared that one of the Greeks would destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that he himself was the one signified, and, pleased at the time, he dismissed the crowd, but the next day summoned them and told them to ask for whatever gifts they wished. When the high priest asked that they be permitted to live by their ancestral laws, and that the 7th year be free of tribute, he granted everything. They further asked him to allow the Jews in Babylon and Media also to live by their own laws, and he gladly promised to do as they requested. And when he said to the crowd that, if any of them wished to serve with him as soldiers while still keeping their ancestral customs and living according to them, he was ready to take them along, many eagerly welcomed the chance to campaign with him. Having settled these matters at Jerusalem, Alexander marched on with his army against the neighboring cities. Everywhere he was received with warmth by those to whom he came. But the Samaritans, whose chief city was then Shechem, which lies by Mount Gerizim and was inhabited by renegades from the Jewish nation, seeing how splendidly Alexander had honored the Jews, decided to claim that they themselves were Jews. For the Samaritans are of such a character, as we have already shown before. When the Jews are in misfortune, they deny being their kinsmen, thereby confessing the truth of the matter. But whenever they see some stroke of good fortune come to them, they leap at once to claim relationship, saying they belong to them, and tracing their own descent from Ephraim and Manasses, the sons of Joseph. With great pomp, then, and displaying much eagerness on his behalf, they went out to meet the king, not far from Jerusalem. When Alexander praised them, the people of Shechem came up to him, bringing with them also the soldiers whom Sanballat had sent to him, and asked him, when he came to their city, to honor their temple as well. He promised he would look into the matter on his return. But when they asked him to remit the tribute of the sabbatical year, since they did not sow in it, he inquired who they were to be making such a request. When they said they were Hebrews, but were known as the Sidonians of Shechem, he asked them again whether they happened to be Jews. When they said they were not, he replied, "But it was to the Jews that I granted these things. Still, when I return and am more accurately informed by you, I will do what seems best." With these words, he dismissed the people of Shechem. As for the soldiers of Sanballat, he ordered them to follow him into Egypt, since there he would give them allotments of land, which shortly afterward he in fact did, in the Thebaid, assigning them to garrison the region. When Alexander died, his empire was divided among his successors, but the temple on Mount Garizim remained standing. And whenever anyone at Jerusalem was charged with eating forbidden food, or violating the Sabbath, or any other such offense, he would flee to the people of Shechem, claiming he had been unjustly expelled. By that time, the high priest Jaddus, too, had already died, and his son Onias had succeeded to the high priesthood. Such, then, was the state of affairs concerning the people of Jerusalem.